Hello and welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast for leaders of FIEC churches and other churches too. You're very welcome. This is our regular roundup of the news. You'll notice that, and then there were two, we've lost our northern voice. Phil Topham is off doing something northern today, isn't he? He's having a day off, well-deserved holiday. He's going wine tasting, I think. That's what people in the north do. And we wish him well in his wine tasting. No doubt he will come back on Monday an expert and be able to tell us what wines we should be buying, John. Looking forward to that. FIEC solidly in the north. We're looking at the news, you and I. Yep. We're going to have a think about some of the items that are on in the news. It's been a fairly sobering week in many ways, hasn't it? I mean, there are always sobering stories, I guess, in the news. We've woken up to news. It's still developing, really. We've woken up to news of Israel with preemptive strikes on Iran. 100 planes, I think, 200 planes involved in the attacks, and also claiming the life of the leader of the Revolutionary Guard in Iran. Is he? I've got his name written down somewhere. Hossein Salami, yeah. That's right. Now, it's difficult to know. We've talked about Israel before and the situation in the Middle East. We recognise it's extraordinarily complex. But a country does have a right to defend itself as well, doesn't it? And there's something about preemptive strikes, which is what these are, in terms of protection, that is important for us to recognise as a just war. Is that right?
Yeah, I think absolutely right. I mean, the whole issue here has been the threat of Iran developing nuclear weapons,
and that's right.
Much of the world has been concerned to ensure that that doesn't happen. I think that's basically because of the ideology of the Iranian leadership, and their theological views, the particular form of Islam, which kind of looks to
the country is not just neutral
future.
Towards Israel.
No, they want the destruction of Israel.
Exactly.
I must say that is totally different, perhaps, from the views of the Iranian people. Many of our churches will have significant numbers of Iranians. We've seen large numbers of Iranians being converted. We must differentiate between those two. They're not supporters of this regime and its ideology.
That's right.
But it has been a growing threat. Actually, a couple of days ago, the International Atomic Energy Agency warned that Iran was in danger of breaching the sort of non-proliferation obligations. For years, Western countries have been trying to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. And I think it's not unexpected that Israel has struck against their facilities and against their leadership to prevent that happening. They are saying that Iran was not far away from developing nuclear weapons, and I think there must have been a genuine and real danger that they would use them in relation
to Israel. And ongoing attacks, 100 drone attacks in recent weeks.
I mean, there's a history to this, of course, that back in the 1980s, the Israelis bombed an Iraqi nuclear reactor to prevent Iraq gaining a nuclear bomb. That protected the world from Saddam Hussein having nuclear weapons. Mm. There have been other attacks on Iranian facilities. There was a sort of a cyber attack that meant all of their centrifuges ran at high speed, which completely disrupted their uranium enrichment. So people have been trying to prevent Iran gaining these kind of weapons. And no doubt there's a tacit awareness on the part of the West that Israel has taken this action to hold them back. And you're absolutely right. I think biblically, and actually as Christians has wrestled with just war theory, where there is a real danger of aggression, a preemptive attack, it can be an appropriate and legitimate response. Again, just war theory requires that to be proportionate to the threat. But that is a perfectly legitimate action for nations to take to protect themselves.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep looking at that as the story develops. Now, I want to talk about some things, other things that have been happening in the news this week. And in terms of UK news, perhaps one of the most significant things that's happened is the government's announced its spending review. I think, as far as I can discover it, John, Rachel Reeves has discovered the magic money tree, which is great news, of course. So £29 billion extra for the NHS, £20 billion extra for infrastructure, defence going up, home improvements, £13 billion, some of which is going to be funded by cuts in other departments, some of it's going to be funded by the mysterious efficiency savings, which is always a good place, isn't it, to go for your savings. And it does seem, doesn't it, that it's a splurge. I mean, it's not a budget, so it's not trying to balance the books. It's just announcing what the next round of spending is going to be. And suddenly we've gone from there's no money. In fact, there's a massive big hole. So there's lots of money. What are we to make of that?
Well, at one level, I think the spending review has been anticipated. This government has been in for a year. It takes a bit of time for them to get to grips with everything, what the situation is and what's needed. So at one level, a comprehensive plan for investment in the future, what the government wants to do, has not been clear. So this is massively significant in terms of setting the trajectory for the next sort of 5 years, and some of these projects for the next decade, or so, and it's a commitment to a massive capital investment has been the picture that's there. You're right, she hasn't explained where the money is necessarily going to come from. She would say that as this unfolds, the economy will recover and the gap will be picked up. So this is...
Well, the news this week wasn't good on that because the economy shrunk last month. There wasn't the growth that they needed.
Although whether that was a shock as a result of the kind of the Trump tariffs, because the bigger trend beyond that had been growth. Well, we're not here to say the government is doing the right or the wrong thing. Right. I mean, these are the challenges of government. The public has certain demands. They do want public services. They do want investment. They do want infrastructure improved. So these are allocations of resources to things people want: healthcare, defence, housing. Mm. And at one level, those things don't come without cost. At the same time, the public is generally resistant to paying for those things or wants others to pay for them. They always think there's somebody else who will be able to generate the money. And I think that's the massive challenge of modern government is how can you deliver what people want, which of course ultimately determines whether they're going to vote for you and support you and pay for it when people basically don't want to pay.
I guess it's analogous to church life as well, isn't it? I mean, there are always demands on our money. Mm. In church life. And one of the features of independence, of course, is that we essentially raise our own money. We might get grants and help from one or two other places, but basically we have to fund things within the church, don't we? And I wonder if there's some lessons here for leaders. We have to lead the church in money as well as leading the church in other areas. Mm. And I wonder if sometimes we abrogate that. We just kind of pass that responsibility on to the treasurer. You know, he can do the report at the church meeting, whatever it is. But actually, it's a key part of church life, isn't it? Raising money through people's giving and spending that wisely in ways that will bless the church, where there are always competing demands on what you might spend money on. Most churches are operating, you know, close to the bone. They haven't got huge sums of money in the bank to call upon. What does it look like for a leader to lead wisely when it comes to money, do you think? It's such an embarrassing thing to talk about, isn't it, for Brits? You mustn't talk about money. Mm. You know, how do we do that wisely? How do we lead? Often we're not accountants or economists. Arguably, some members of the government are not either. Mm. But, you know, how do we lead in money?
Well, in many ways, I think honesty and openness is absolutely key to that. We sort of mustn't be hiding. We need to be transparent about the financial situation in our churches. And we need, I think, to be honest with people as to what the needs are, the choices are, and the costs of pursuing those. Mm. I mean, in some ways, we had a church meeting last sort of Sunday, and Adrian, you were presenting the figures to us of our church.
I was.
We've got to make choices as to what we can do as a church. We're at the moment running a deficit because we have some reserve funds, but that's not going to last forever. No. So we have to sort of put that reality before the congregation, urge people to be generous in giving, but yet at the same time recognise that some individuals are not able to give more. Some may even have to give less because of the impact on their lives. So in a sense, what were your lessons from doing that helped the church?
Well, I've always tried to be very generous when it comes to money, to think actually that my own conviction is what people do is they have a conviction before the Lord. I think that's biblical as to what they should give. We are to call people to give generously. I don't think there's a biblical percentage. Some people say it's a tithe still. I don't see a tithe in the New Testament the same way. I think the principle is generosity, which interestingly for most people in the West is probably more than 10%. 10% possibly lets some people off the hook, so to speak. We're to give generously and sacrificially. And I think that means encouraging people to review what they're giving regularly. So as I presented at the church meeting, and I think we've always tried to do this, for some people at some moments, that means they should reduce their giving. And I think they need to hear that from us as leaders. That actually there may be certain circumstances they find themselves in. They've lost a job or family situation has changed, whatever it may be, other calls upon their money, that actually at the moment it's right for them to reduce their giving. And I think we need to not just give permission to people to do that, but to say, actually, that might be the right thing for you to do, and not to kind of tut and, you know, roll our eyes at that. Equally, I think a lot of people don't review their giving in church life. We had an example. I've been in the church 8 years, and we had an example that the inflation rate over those 8 years has been 33%. So actually, if I was giving £100 back 8 years ago, I should now be giving £133. And lots of people don't review their giving. So I think it's not just the content we put into how we present the finances, John. I think it's the tone in which we do it that is really important. But we've got to be honest as well, haven't we? There are trade-offs. You can't do everything.
Yeah.
And so you are trading off one thing against another. And I think that's part of leadership. It's sometimes making the difficult decisions. We can invest in this kind of role, but we can't invest in that kind of role. We can invest in a youth worker, but not an evangelist. Or we can invest in an evangelist, but not a youth worker. Sometimes those are trade-offs that leaders have to make, and they have to justify those decisions. That's part of leadership, I think.
It is. It's part of life, isn't it? That's what we all have to do in our families. Yeah. You can't have everything that you want. You have to make your choices between different things. So most people have to select and choose. There's a danger of borrowing to have things that you can't really afford, which is unrealistic. I thought that it seems to me as leaders, we have to be on top of the finances in the details.
Yeah.
So as elders, as we gather together to work through all of what's going on in the church, we don't know what individuals give, but we do know where the money is spent and the costs of various things. I thought what you did really well on Sunday was to present the big picture to the church, because there's a danger that most ordinary church members simply are not going to be able to get down into the details. Mm. You know, there's a danger of getting people discussing the amount of money that's spent on sort of photocopying.
It's always photocopying.
Whereas actually what they need to see is the really big picture and the really big trends. And I thought that was presented with clarity, some helpful graphics that did that. So everybody now understands where we are.
Mm.
And I think if there's a bigger picture out of the government's sort of whole financial planning and budgets, it seems to me there is this having to make choices. Governments talk about making hard choices. Nobody ever really likes to do that. They want to give people the impression that there aren't hard choices, but you do have to prioritize.
Yeah.
And I think the need to be honest with people about the costs of things. So I think one of the real dangers in our politics is that everybody ends up not being honest about the cost of things because some other party will pretend you can have it without cost. Mm. Actually, one of the things that's very striking about Jesus is his honesty in describing the cost. There are not blessings without cost.
Yes, that's right.
And nor is there a place for a blind faith that just says everything will work out all right and we're not really believing it will just happen. You have to have a realism, which is not the same as a conservatism. There is a right faith for what you can do and what God can provide.
Yeah.
But that is not a blind faith that you can just do what you want and it will be okay.
I mean, the conservatives financially often need to be a bit more ambitious. And those who are extraordinarily ambitious need to be a bit more realistic. There's often sort of a meeting in the middle, isn't there? And I do think sometimes those trade-offs mean, the biblical principles remain the same. So a worker deserves his wages, for example. So if your choice is, we could pay two people not particularly well and not really enough to live on, or we could pay one person well, a church will often choose the former because they think it would be nice to have two workers. But actually the better biblical choice is the latter. And I think that's what leadership is making those hard decisions and being able to explain to church, no, it's better we employ one person, look after them and pay them properly than actually scrape around to not really pay two people very well at all.
And a note of encouragement, we as an SLT were looking at the results of our data survey.
As our leadership team, we ought to say
our leadership team. Yeah. And actually, one of the questions we've asked our churches about their financial situation, and it was wonderfully encouraging that even through a period of challenges in the economy, cost of living crises, lots of our churches have reported that their giving has increased significantly. For most of our churches, it's not a major worrying concern for the leaders. And actually, that was just wonderful to have that hard data from our churches that people are generous in giving, and our churches are growing and they're investing and doing things.
Now, in other news, the bromance is over. John, you and I have fallen out. No, I mean Elon Musk and Donald Trump. I don't know which of us is Elon Musk or which of us is Donald Trump. Best not to ask. Write in. There's been a massive falling out. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, really. It happened over a week ago, but it's still in the news. They're continuing to trade insults on Twitter and Truth Social and various other platforms. And in fact, they're withdrawing compliments as well. They're not just trading insults. They're withdrawing nice things they've said in the past. So Donald and Elon have well and truly fallen out. There's obviously a lot of politics involved in this and all the rest of it. But they appear to be more than just allies. They appear to be good mates, you know, the way they were speaking about one another. And it seems to have been a catastrophic failing. What's gone on?
It's hard to know. We're not on the inside of that. I mean, at one level, it has been a massive falling out over a matter of policy, really, that Elon Musk has come in as an entrepreneur, given a brief of cutting back government. That was the role that he had. That's why he supported Donald Trump.
His money again, isn't it?
A very powerful advocate for him. Well, it's a vision of what kind of society and state you ought to be. Yep. And Donald Trump is then proposing a very significant tax-cutting bill in Congress, which will significantly increase the American debt. I guess Musk believes that as a matter of principle, that's the very opposite of the things that he was campaigning for. So, and I think actually this indicates a bit of a more general issue across various more right-leaning parties at the moment, is that they often are a coalition of people with two very different visions. On the one hand, a protectionist vision that wants to spend more, that looks to the interests of certain class groups in society and wants to provide benefits for them and therefore is willing to spend a tax. And another group which is wanting to radically cut the state, cut tax, free up entrepreneurship. And actually those two groups, when they actually have to make decisions, are diametrically opposed to each other. Yeah. So they can join together to be anti-others, but actually they're not a coherent policy platform. Mm. And I think at one level that's emerged. So there is a division of policy, and every party and every group will have divisions of policy, recognize that in all areas of life. But this has also become much more personal because there's so much ego bound up in it of the individuals. And that's compounded by the way that it's instantly gone onto social media. And it, I think it shows the real danger of social media becoming a forum for...
Yeah, so I agree. Although there's nothing new in the public spat, is that? I mean, you think of Lord Howe's resignation speech from Thatcher's government and just sort of, you know, some of the things that do go on. I mean, they are still publicly reported and do have a significant impact, don't they? But there's a more of an immediacy about this because of social media.
It's instant, I think it escalates very quickly. Yeah. So... Lord Howe was criticising Margaret Thatcher's leadership. Elon Musk leapt into raising issues of Jeffrey Epstein and making allegations that the nature of the language, the way that it was conducted. I mean, Jeffrey Howe was always described as being savaged by a sort of a dead slipper. So, I mean, at one level, that's quite different from what happens
contemporary
on social
news
media,
reference there.
But we are very used to how, or we've become used to how social media spats just explode. Yeah. And it's kind of like pouring petrol onto the issue. And I think there's a real lesson for us as leaders and as Christians to be very careful about how we engage on social media, what we say, spur of the moment comments. I mean, we see that in some sense with the case of some of the people who tweeted kind of in the light of the sort of riots after the tragic killing of the young girls in the dance studios in Southport. At one level, people instantly went onto social media and said stupid things. There's just that immense danger and a restraint in speaking.
Mm. Mm. You've mentioned Southport. Let's turn to another story, which is about a tragedy. Mm. And I want to particularly take one line on this. So other news is that yesterday, terrible plane crash in India, Boeing 787, en route from Ahmedabad to in India, in Gujarat, to Gatwick, crashed, killing everybody on board, apart from extraordinarily one man from Leicester, just up the road, who can't quite understand how he escaped. He sort of walked away from the wreckage, literally. So 242 on board, lots of people on the ground. A terrible tragedy. We don't quite know what's happened yet. And again, in the social media world, it's not just a news report. There's videos, not just of the wreckage, but actually of the crash happening and all those sorts of things. There's not much to say about that in terms of, you know, how that relates to us as leaders, that particular issue, although you may, I guess, have people in your church who have been affected by it. But I'd like to talk more broadly about tragedy and how we deal with that as leaders. So a lot of church life is very humdrum. It's very ordinary. You know, we have people who are born, we have people who die, but that's often sort of part of the cycle of life, isn't it? I'm thinking more in terms of the interruptions to that ordinariness. So what happens when there's an untimely death? I was hearing from a church leader this week who was just saying someone in the church has just died in their early 20s, very untimely, small church, fragile church plant. It's really shocked them. It's really knocked them back. Or it may be something that happens in your locality. You mentioned Southport and how churches responded to that terrible tragedy that was there. In the past, we've, of course, had the Soham murders. We've had a colleague who was a pastor in Soham at the time, and just knowing how to respond to that. How do we lead through the unexpected, especially when it feels very personal? I guess some of these things are national tragedies. They're one step removed. Sometimes they're in the church. You know, a person in the church is affected, or it's actually someone in the church who's perhaps died, or some terrible crime has been committed. How do we lead churches through that?
I think at one level, there's a difference between a tragedy that's actually affected individuals and how they need pastoring. That's a very different situation of the loving care and the support that they need. So if there are particular people within a church who are affected by a tragedy, or they might be experiencing re-trauma because of a tragedy that's similar to a tragedy they've experienced. Yeah. And I think they need loving support. And comfort is a hugely important biblical idea,
yeah.
the idea of comforting people, and that is partly through the word, it's partly through the love of the community one for another. So there is a right and proper place for a comfort. But I think some of these tragedies also touch us, even though we're not actually particularly involved in them. And tragedies often reveal to us, there's a sort of a terrible things happening in the world that we kind of just take for granted.
Right.
An old person dies and we think, well, that's just normal.
Yeah.
You know, more than 236 people will have probably been killed in Ukraine on the front line in the last day.
Yeah.
But yet that happens every day and we become just used to it and it doesn't touch us in the same way. There's something about a tragedy like this that confronts us because it's unexpected. It seems to come from nowhere. People were not anticipating, you get on a plane and you think it's going to be fine. And it's the shock of it, the kind of interruption. But in a way, that brings home to us something about the nature of the fallen
world. Yes, and it resonates
with
people. I think that's helpful, isn't it? Because, lots of us have been on planes or go on planes. We don't stand in the front line of a battle zone. Mm. So in a sense, there's a point of connection there, isn't there?
And it's in the media and there's a video of the plane going down, which makes us just much feel... more closely connected with it. So these are moments that bring home something of the tragedy of the world that we are in more generally. Mm. So I think these moments of tragedy actually ought to open our eyes to the far bigger picture of the tragedy that is there all the time, but we actually become immune to.
Yes.
And in some ways, Jesus said that when he was talking about the kind of the Tower of Siloam.
That's
that
right,
fell.
Yes. The call is to repent, isn't it?
Jesus' response was basically, don't think that they were worse than you.
No.
In a sense, the same judgment awaits us all.
Yeah.
And I think actually at an existential level, that's often what these things bring home to us. They bring home the fragility of life, the fact that we are not in control, the fact that we are mortal. And sometimes just things crystallize that for us in a moment. They make us aware of the reality of life, whereas we spend most of our time ignoring it.
Yeah, okay.
So I think there is comfort. There is also opportunity. To just bring the hope of the gospel to bear, not in a cynical and manipulative way, but it is a moment often in which people are touched and maybe they are open to consider some of those eternal, personal, existential issues in a way that at other times they're not.
This is interesting, isn't it, in the history of the world when there have been national tragedies of some kind. People talk about there has been some kind of response to it. So that happened after 9/11, I think. There was a national response to that. It was a very interesting book of sermons that were preached at moments of national tragedy, including Tim Keller's sermon that he preached after 9/11. And it is a call to repentance. And I think also it's just a reminder, just a little sort of tip for you if you're listening and you're a preacher or a leader. Do check the news headlines before you go to church. Mm. Seems like a silly thing. But actually, if you arrive at church and you've woken up to some news that you don't know about and everybody else in the church knows about, that can really make church very difficult. I think the best example of that is when Princess Diana died. That was a Sunday morning. I was leading a church service and I did look at the news headlines. I try not to look at my phone on Sunday mornings, but I looked at the news headlines. I thought it's a good thing to do before church. And I was glad I had, because everyone else arrived at church in various states of distress and anxiety and all the rest of it that went along with that incident. So actually, you do need to check the news, don't you, before you go to church. It's a good tip.
You do. I mean, I think dealing with many things, the basic biblical framework and worldview is really helpful. So often what we're doing is we're applying that to situations and people. A God who has created a good world, who is sovereign in control of all things. These things happen, but they're not an indication that God is not in control. In ways that we may not understand, he is at work overseeing all of these things. We live in a fallen world, which is subject to curse, decay, frustration.
Yeah.
Not necessarily everything is an active, immediate judgment because of sin, but actually we live in a world which is flawed and stuff goes wrong. Mm. Death is part of our world because of that sort of flaw. And then we've got the hope of redemption.
Yes.
You know, what we have a longing for as human beings is that all of this can be removed and dealt with. That's why so much energy will go into checking planes, finding out what the cause was, trying to prevent it happening again. We try to eliminate tragedy. Mm. But we never can completely.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, the hope of redemption is what we look forward to.
So death is part of our world, John. One of my favourite parts of the news are the obituaries. my children laugh at me because when we watch, the Oscars or the BAFTAs or something like that is on, the minute I perk up is the minute where they tell you all the people who have died in the last year. Mm. Just because I like sort of seeing if I can remember who they were. So it's been an interesting week because four people have died in this last week. I think who will tell us something about the world we're living in. So I've written them down just to make sure I get it right. So Sly Stone from Sly and the Family Stone, has died, aged 82, danced to the music, one of my favourite songs. A remarkable musician who really was one of the first musicians to fuse black music and white music and attract an integrated audience in the States, which is, at the time, late 60s, was an extraordinary thing really to be happening. I think he was described, someone once described James Brown as the person who invented funk, but Sly Stone perfected it, which I think is a great way of describing it. So Sly Stone died. Frederick Forsyth died, one of my favourite authors, 16 novels, nearly all in some way connected with the Cold War or geopolitics. He was 86, but really a kind of a Cold War novelist in many ways. And Brian Wilson's died. Brian Wilson, kind of the slightly troubled lead singer and songwriter of the Pet Shop Boys. I was going to say, it's not the Pet Shop Boys. I'm getting confused now. The Beach Boys. Pet Sounds 1966 was their big album. And again, transformed the way music moved from one particular genre and things became mainstream, having been quite niche. And then finally, someone who died perhaps in a bit more of an untimely way, Uriah Rennie died this week. He was age 65. Uriah Rennie had a terrible neurological disorder, but he was the Premiership's first black referee. And interesting to me, because although he was the first black referee, and black referees are still not that common in the Premiership and in football as a whole, it is more common and less unusual now. He was a trailblazer, really. And our colleague, who's absent, the chair is on my left, like Tiny Tim, isn't it? And the chair is absent on the left. He's a Bolton fan. He loved Uriah Rennie because he was quite a brave referee as well. I mean, he not only got lots of racist abuse, but actually he was brave in his decisions. So you've got four people, I think, that just show how the world is changing, the way that sort of integration has happened and that music has become more universalized across different genres. I think you probably see that in Brian Wilson as well. You see Frederick Forsyth, who basically said he gave up writing novels because he had nothing else to write about once the Cold War had sort of settled. And then you've got Uriah Rennie. I think you just demonstrates that actually we're moving to a more multicultural society where people from different ethnicities and backgrounds are welcome and integrated and part of what's going on. So that the world is not as it was in 1966 when Pet Sounds was kind of first done, was it?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think these kind of, they remind us that the world has massively changed, yeah. In some ways positively, in some ways not
it's
just, necessarily
It's not all positive, no.
And it
no.
certainly hasn't worked out the way that people necessarily thought. No. So I think back to the Beach Boys and, in a sense, a remarkable optimism.
Were you alive then? I wasn't alive.
I do remember people in the 1980s rediscovering it. But this remarkable optimism about America and the future, this kind of surfing lifestyle, California is the promised land.
Yeah, yeah.
And at one level, it was only an elite that were enjoying that. At one level, that is what people aspired to, and that's what they hoped for. And it was a kind of a period of American dominance. At one level, it was a vision that in some ways was questionable. California, the place where there are two girls for every guy. I mean, there's a sort of a particular kind of male view of the world that was there. But it was this kind of slightly happy-go-lucky, everything is going to get better kind of world. And of course, it's not worked out like that. The things that were sort of thought in the 60s simply haven't generated that kind of world. Both Brian Wilson and also Sly Stone were both, in the end, ultimately severely affected by drugs that they took.
They were, yes, they were.
And Brian Wilson effectively said, the weird thing I wish I'd never done was take psychedelic drugs. Mm. And again, that was a sort of a feature of the 1960s. So things that, if you'd been alive in the 1960s and that had been the worldview that you'd bought into, which loads of people did, from the perspective of now, it's just not worked out that way, and it hasn't worked. Mm. To some extent, Frederick Forsyth has reflected a much more the darker side of society, the struggle, the conflict, the fight that's kind of underneath. And you think, actually, we do in our world wrestle with these two things. Kind of, there's a desire for an optimism for it all to work out and all to be fun, but there's a reality of a conflict under the surface.
And we want to be contemporary as churches, don't we? That doesn't mean that we have to embrace the world, but it means we have to connect with the world, doesn't it? So as someone once described, we were talking about this the other day, weren't we, a church which, if the 1950s ever came back, they would be ready and waiting. And, you know, church culture can be a bit like that. And we want to fight against just adopting everything the world does because the world does it. That's not right. That's not biblical. We want to fight against that. That is a fight, isn't it? That's part of what it means, I think, to live as Christians. On the other hand, we don't want to hold on to cultural antiquity for its own sake. do we? We want to be appropriately contemporary. I think that's a good place to be.
I think that's right. And I think that popular culture, it seems to me what it does is popular culture exposes what people's aspirations and desires and longings are, it exposes what their fears are. Popular culture will be a barometer of those things. What popular culture generally doesn't do is provide you with an answer to those things. So I think from a Christian perspective, we need to listen to it in order to actually understand what people's hopes and dreams, what their fears are. And then that helps us to bring the gospel to bear on those. But it's a mistake if we think that popular culture has the answer to those problems.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
But
right.
Equally, sometimes Christian attempts to provide an answer in past generations are not the answer either.
For example?
Well, I think you can go back to the Puritan periods and its vision of a society, a godly society run and ruled from the top. It didn't work out. It wasn't possible because people weren't believers. You then ended up with religious conflict and religious wars. It's all too easy to read back to what people did 300-400 years ago and think that that is what we need to do today. And I think actually a realistic history will say they got something right, they got some things wrong. It didn't work out. It's not necessarily an ideal. Yeah. You've got to rethink in every generation, how does the gospel work out in this particular context? There is no simplistic answer from some period of history that you can just seize and replicate today, and that is what's needed. Yeah,
that's right. Thanks, John. We're done for time. Thank you so much. It's been just enjoyable, always enjoyable to chat about the news, even though it's been a sobering week. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed the podcast, do rate and review us because it helps people find us. I'm off for a weekend of 70s music, which seems appropriate, actually. I genuinely am off for a weekend of 70s music. I think you're off surfing, are you, John? Something like that. So we'll catch up with you soon. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.